drab, with temperatures held back no more than, 11 or 12 degrees at best. But elsewhere, the cloud will tend to break up. The persistent rain will be followed by a scattering of showers, one or two quite sharp showers across the heart of England through the afternoon. But most of us will avoid these, actually, and see some sunshine, and that'll help the temperatures, so it'll feel a bit warmer than it has done, typically up into the mid-teens. A glance towards the end of the week, the best of the sunshine will start to be across the more southern parts of the UK, and here we'll get up into the low 20s in one or two places. For Scotland and Northern Ireland, though, a change in the weather. Weak weather fronts will be pushing in, so cloudier and cooler for a couple of days with some patchy outbreaks of rain. But for the weekend, actually a lot of dry weather, sunniest in the south. Neil.
Many thanks, John Hammond. Now, our book of the week, The North and Almost Everything in It. The music journalist and broadcaster Paul Morley contemplates the North and what it means to come from the North, continuing his journey back to the streets of his youth with echoes of the iconic voices from his youth. Morley today contemplates how he came to be a Northerner, with additional readings from Paul Hilton.
There was a grubby small front room in our Westbourne Grove house in Reddish, containing bits of junk and old furniture, which embarrassed me so much in front of my friends, none of whom seemed to have rooms as messy, as unused as ours, with such drab peeling wallpaper and a stained carpet curling up at the edges, tired of life the way carpets get, that I still redden thinking about it to this day, 50 years later. The room at the back was where we all lived, where we functioned as a family to the respective limits of our abilities, and hankered after the kind of cosiness that might fix us together. It was where I was a mite scared when news came from upstairs from the back bedroom that my new sister Carol had been born, in what must have been such a nighttime burst of blood, fluid and shock that no one ever talked about it.
For a sketch with a continuity announcer, Victoria Wood wrote the line, "I'd like to apologise to viewers in the North. It must be awful for them."
A coal fire needed to be quickly built as soon as we woke up, around seven. Firmly twisted copies of the Daily Express, my dad's favourite newspaper, laid on top of a few pieces of coal. Mum, 5'3", her fine, fair hair so set, swept and 60s it was almost a beehive, would perform the morning newspaper twisting, with a strength that made me think of televised Saturday afternoon wrestling. After early morning fire duty, my mum would make tea. My dad took a big dollop of milk and 3 teaspoons of sugar, probably craving enough energy to get out of the door and head for work and his unnamed occupation, which was never clearly described to me, but which, from odd clues I picked up, seemed to consist of hours of paperwork, boredom and irritation in an office. If there was some sort of ladder of seniority, from what I could gather, he was at the bottom, with no chance of ever being a boss. This, I am guessing, made him bitter. It was a bitterness that would develop over the years, so that his story, even in 1967, when he was a surely youthful 31, was already well on the way to becoming a disaster. His mother, my grandmother, confined to a solitary life in Margate, never explained that my grandfather had deserted them when my father was a young boy during the war. She was not someone who praised others much and didn't seem keen on making people feel good. Victoria Wood has said that this is a northern thing, the grudging handing out, if at all, of encouragement or motivation. But in my grandmother's case, it was a very distant Southern Methodist thing, a reluctance perhaps to express love to a human product, physical reminder of a soured wartime marriage. I remember once travelling to Margate for our annual summer holiday, in which pain and pleasure would be mixed up with the Kent sunshine that seemed organised by Enid Blyton. We set off from Reddish in the early evening. My dad had overestimated how long the journey would take, so he made it into Margate before dawn at about 4 a.m. He was too scared to arrive this early at his mother's house and have to wake her up. So the five of us sat or awkwardly slept in the Vauxhall Viva, parked a mile or so away by Cliftonville's Dane Park. 7 o'clock was deemed the correct moment to arrive, once his mother had been up and about for a good half hour. Nothing was mentioned when we got to the house. My dad passed on to me the feeling that your past is of no real help in working out who you are, finding your voice and establishing a steady, mature identity. He didn't perhaps mean to, but he passed on the notion that to be alive is to be a fraud, adrift from reason and reality. You lie and evade to make people believe in you, and finding your own voice must always be a fruitless task. Perhaps it was this that made me consider being a writer, even though as a writer, finding a voice often involves a fair amount of lying and deceiving, or at least making things up.
Alan Bennett. I was born and brought up in Leeds, where my father was a butcher, and as a boy I sometimes used to go out with the orders delivering the meat. One of our customers was a nice woman called Mrs. Fletcher, and I used to go to her house, and she had a daughter called Valerie. Valerie went to London and became a secretary, and she got a job with a publishing firm and became secretary to the chairman, whom she eventually married. Now, the publishing firm was Faber and Faber, and the chairman was T.S. Eliot. So there was a time early in life when I thought my only connection with literature would be that I once delivered meat to T.S. Eliot's mother-in-law.
I was not born in the north. I was born in Farnham, Surrey, a few miles from Aldershot, where my father was doing his 18-month national service, 5 years before conscription ended. My mum and dad had been married for 6 months. After the army, the three of us stayed with my grandmother in Margate and in a flat in Dover, before my quick-thinking but underqualified dad got a job as a prison warder at the maximum security Parkhurst prison on the Isle of Wight. Perhaps my road to northernness began when my father, alienated by his strict and frosty mother, stumped by a missing father, rattled and psychically bruised by draining daily confrontations with murderers and sundry violent criminals, became more receptive to suggestions from my homesick mother that they move north closer to her parents in Hanforth, near Wilmslow. We moved in time for my first school to be a northern school, a few months with my mum's parents and then a move into Eccles, 4 miles to the west of Manchester city centre. We didn't last long in Eccles, enough perhaps to begin the piecing together of my important new identity, a process which became intensive once we moved to Reddish. Although I have no idea of exactly when we moved to Reddish, I have decided for the sake of this history that I arrived there on the 13th of June, 1963. This was the day that the Beatles played their one and only gig in Stockport, at the Offerton Palace Theatre Club. They'd been booked a few months earlier when they were relatively unknown, but by mid-1963 they were causing the world to talk of something called Beatlemania. Booked to appear later that night in Gorton, the route they would have taken from Offerton would have gone through Reddish, past my new house, and to a building that would become more and more important in my life, Reddish Library. I like to think that Reddish Library was where I learned to read, and where, without me even understanding what was happening, I began to write, or at least to have the thoughts that can become writing. When I was 12, I took 2 books by George Orwell out of the library. I didn't understand a word of either book, but I remember thinking that they were magnificent. There was something in these books that implied that my library card, which was a small, rough scrap of stiff brown card, which I wish I still had, was some sort of ticket to the future.
Les Dawson's bricklayer father struggled to find work during the Depression. The podgy schoolboy, nicknamed Dossie, dreamed of becoming a famous writer, spurred on by an enthusiastic English teacher. I was born in Manchester in the 30s. It was a depressed decade, and most of the people who lived in our area were decayed. Our terraced house was so narrow, the mice walked about on their back legs. The kitchen ceiling was so low, the oven had a foot-level grill.
I was vaguely aware that in the early to mid-60s my father worked for British European Airways. He was then in his late 20s, with a lean, hopeful look that seemed to belong to tomorrow, and aerodynamic slick back hair with a neatly combed bilcream dash of 1962 Sean Connery. He brought back with him from work a sense of something exciting, and in keeping with talk of a white-hot technological revolution. A small zip-up bag with a red, slightly slanted BEA logo printed on each side in the centre seemed connected to the space age and was definitely a jet-set snippet of glamour in our worn-down house. I don't know exactly what happened to cause him to leave the BEA sales office, except there were rumours in our house that it involved a mysterious woman at work and an affair that motivated my mum to storm Deansgate and bring a little old-fashioned working-class vim to the modernised surroundings. His next job, though, still seemed linked to the technological revolution. He moved to the new computer centre that Shellmex and BP had built in Withenshaw to partner a similar complex in Hemel Hempstead. I never went to visit my dad at his work in Withenshaw, which remained a mystery. It was a drive from Reddish of about 8 miles. If I had gone, it would have been 10 stops on the bus from Mersey Square, Stockport. Eventually, I would visit all of the places on the bus route from Stockport to Withenshaw, and on the train line to New Mills and beyond to Buxton, because it became apparent very early on living in Reddish that one place led to another, and then another. And it was amazing how far you could go if you just kept going. If you didn't keep going, you would stay put forever where you were.
In 1854, Queen Victoria visited York, her one and only visit to the city. She was allegedly asked to pay for her meal at the Royal Station Hotel. She was shocked and said she would never visit York again. Apparently, whenever the royal train passed through York afterwards, she always made sure the blinds were firmly pulled down.
For me and my dad, Reddish was mostly a base for talking about and watching Manchester City. Reddish was within walking distance of the City Ground main road, although it did take an hour to walk, and we usually went in my dad's car. I knew it could be walked because sometimes Dad had no car or no money for petrol. I took this lack of money in my stride. I didn't really know where his money came from anyway, or where it went.
The 1884 FA Cup final between Blackburn Rovers and the amateurs of Scottish club Queen's Park was held in London. The Accrington Times reported the Pall Mall Gazette's reaction to the northern football crowd. To the amazement of the populace, the capital witnessed an invasion of northern barbarians on Saturday. Hot-blooded Lancastrians, sharp of tongue, rough and ready of uncouth garb and speech, a tribe of Sudanese Arabs let loose in the Strand would not excite more amusement and curiosity. Whether it's eating, or better still, drinking, or whether there is a little rioting to be done, or such a small matter of a house to be burned down, these Lancashire folk enjoy it with infinite zest.
Whether we drove or walked, we would cross the Wilmslow Road amid the chattering crowds draped in sky blue and white that told us we were close to the ground. For a few miles before that, when walking, we were on our own, crossing the invisible borders from one ward to the next, occasionally spotting as we got closer the ground's floodlights scraping the sky like medieval metal warriors above the surrounding crouched houses bunched up in terror. The walk was worth it to see City win, which for a few years into the early 1970s they usually did, in the sort of style that meant I would crave a repeat for the rest of my life.
Tomorrow, in Manchester's Free Trade Hall, the outside world pulls into the teenage Paul Morley's life as he continues reading The North and Almost Everything in It, with additional voices from Paul Hilton. It was abridged by Viv Beebe and produced by Justine Willett. Here's Sailing By to take us to the shipping forecast. Thank you. And now on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday, the 30th of May. The general synopsis at 1800. New low expected Eastern Europe 996 by 1800 Thursday. Low German Bight 1001 losing its identity. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Etcetera. Variable 4, showers, fog patches. Good, becoming moderate, occasionally very poor. South Etcetera. Northeasterly, backing northwesterly 5, showers, good, occasionally poor. Forties, northerly 4, occasionally 5 in west, occasional rain, fog patches. Moderate, occasionally very poor. Cromarty, 4th. North, 5 or 6, becoming variable 3,